Sometimes environmentalists have been accused of being elitist and of being concerned for the wilderness, while the feeling is that that's taking money and attention from problems of poverty, of education. But these problems should not be played off against each other, the environment and social welfare problems, especially when so much of our nation's resources, of the public resources, are going into defense. And so that social welfare, the programs that are concerned for community welfare, have so much competition for limited funding. And another reason that these should not be played off against each other are that environmental problems often affect most strongly the poor. We're well aware that the use of resources in this country by a small proportion of the world's population far outweighs that which is used in other parts of the country. And we're well aware that the lifestyles of the affluent, even of we who live fairly simple lifestyles, are so much more rich in the world's goods than so many others in the world. So the problems are related, and we can't really keep them separate. Another issue which we've begun to talk about and we'll address further tonight, this is really the crux of the problem, I think, for solving environmental problems, is the economic trade-offs that must be made by a society in order to keep a clean environment. Many of you, I'm sure, are already aware of those issues in your own communities. When a factory pollutes, it costs them more to clean up their processes in order not to pollute, and so they either have to pass that cost on to the consumer or close down and jobs are lost. And so there are other costs to the community because of wanting to clean up the environment. And often the so-called social cost of environmental pollution is not built into the prices of products. I think it has begun to become so over the last 10 or 15 years since some of the environmental legislation has been passed where polluters have been forced to clean up their effluents and their waste. So that cost sometimes is passed on to the consumers. And unless it is, that can be a real problem for that polluting company. And so these are fairly difficult ethical decisions that have to be made about what the society or community needs more, the clean environment or that polluting company, and how those trade-offs are to be decided about. And then that raises the further question, we can talk about this a little bit too, at what level are the decisions to be made concerning the use of resources and the practice of how much we will pollute the environment, or how little can we afford to pollute the environment. Many times when these decisions are made at the community level, it has brought out many conflicts, but their communities are beginning to make decisions about that. Where the issue becomes more crucial and probably more difficult is when we're talking about acid rain, which affects both Canada and the United States, well, which affects Canada and mostly comes from the United States. That has been a sticky problem. And we are, you know, looking ahead, as someone raised the issue the other day of developing countries, some of the developing countries beginning to run into some of the same problems as they industrialize, the same problems that Northern Europe and the United States has gone through in dealing with its pollution. So there are those decisions to be made, and decisions about what types of controls are to be placed on companies, on individuals who pollute. Then the related question to that is who pays for the cleanup? Again, is that something that should be passed on to the consumers, and consumer prices, or should it be a social cost borne by everyone in the form of taxes? I think I'll stop there for a moment before we go on to talking about what we as individuals and communities can do, and ask you to raise some of the, if you have had questions come into your mind as we've talked about these issues, or if you're aware of these types of conflicts between economic and environmental concerns that have taken place in your communities, I'd like to hear about them, and we might talk about some of your thoughts about that, and then be aware about, we'll say 20 minutes or so, we'll continue on then to talk about, and this, it may get us into the discussion of what we can do.
You know, just up the road here from the Marsh North Cascades National Park, there's been a debate raised for about 10 years whether they should build a ski resort right outside the national park. And it was initially the Aspen Corporation came in, who owns most of the ski resort in Aspen, Colorado. And the people who are native to the Methow Valley, which is the area where they want to build it, really wanted the resort. But the people who, sort of like me, moved in to this state from back east and other parts of the country were really opposed to it because it would really change the valley, which is very rural and pristine. But in the 70s, the timber industry collapsed, so there's been very few jobs around here. And it would be very nice. In Washington, we have a lot of skiing, and we don't really have like a destination resort. And I'm a skier, and in a way, I sort of like that. And I know people need jobs, but at the same time, I don't know if anybody's, people here have seen the North Cascades, but it would really change the Methow Valley and the North Cascades forever. But it's been okayed by the Forest Service, but they're still not sure that they're going to be able to build it. It's in port right now. The faction in the valley that doesn't want it built is kind of holding it up. And the Aston Corporation pulled out. Now there's another corporation that's no one knows. And even myself, I have very mixed feelings about it.
It's a very clear case of economic benefit that might come over against what environmental cost is being paid to receive that benefit.
That still require the boat service, the Lady of the Lake, to get there? I mean, that's the same assumption?
No, it's north of the lake. It's up towards the North Cascades Highway.
I see.
And it would definitely have an impact on this area. It would impact the national park, too, because it would be right on the doorstep of the national park. And there's lately been a lot of discussion about, how much development should we have just on the outside, the outer reaches of our national parks, and should there be buffer zones. So it would impact many areas. But I know people personally who live in the Methow who have really been impoverished in the last 10 years because there's just no work over here in eastern Washington. Seattle is economically fairly stable, but rural Washington, it's very bad.
My question would be, if you're concerned about employment in that area, what industry would you take over a ski resort? A cement factory?
I don't know.
Can you expound on your question a little bit more? I mean,
well, the question is, if you want to help people create, you want to create jobs in that area, you have to have some sort of economic activity. And would you take a ski resort, which means people come in through a national forest, because I know that area, you have to come through. From Seattle to there, you have to go through the national, the wilderness area and so on. Or you have to find some other industry. And it could be resurgence of the timber industry, which means we cut more trees. Or you can also put in that area, you could increase the agricultural industry there is near zero. You can increase the river traffic. You can develop wild, rafting and all that sort of stuff. You can probably put in a cement, you could put a cement factory in there, I think.
Ski resort would make one.
I don't know what other alternatives are, but ski resort, people who go to ski resorts like to see them pristine, like to see clean resorts anyway. So it might be the cleanest thing you possibly do.
So you're saying the community should keep, should take into account what other types of development might solve their economic problems, and then decide among those which, then they might take into account which would keep the environment the cleanest and most pristine. Mm-hmm. They may have done that.
It's very interesting. Dog was from the Industrial Development Committee, and this is in northern Minnesota, where it's basically a rural area. And these are always very difficult questions when you have to balance industry with jobs and with people. And in our particular location in northern Minnesota, even the finances for new development aren't a problem. They're there. The problem is the idea and the credulence of the company that wants, you know, that's coming in, and the credulence of the individual that has the idea that wants to start, you know, a company. There are many, many things that are taken into consideration. Ecology is one of them.
Yeah, right. Sure.
But we find that there are write-offs. You have to, in industrialization, if you're going to have jobs, sometimes you have to compromise. The compromise, as far as pollution and these types of things, we've come a long way in the United States. We have a long ways to go. But again, in a trip to Tokyo, other cities around the world were very concerned about, because they are not one bit interested or concerned about pollution. Some of the very rapid growing industrial countries around the world, I mean, as far as acid rain and as far as the whole, you know, circumference of the world in the pollution, we've come a long way in the United States. We have a long way to go. But there are major companies that are, you know, installing pollution devices and to a great deal of expense in there. And we are making some progress. I guess my concern is too, how do we instill this in other developing countries that are industrializing so fast that they're just, I mean, everything is just gray. The air is so polluted that people don't even know.
Yeah, that raises the question of what kinds of international controls are possible. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware, I'm sure that that part of a commission of the United Nations is, I'm sure, is discussing the issues. I'm sorry, haven't been up on that. Yeah.
Going back to the ski resort thing, it seems like the only way to bring in money would be to have people come in, you know, because there's not really, you can't really make the money go around in the place. But and that seems like the thing that causes the environmental problems. So it seems, I mean, this would be really hard to do, but it seems like the best way to solve the problem would be to have federal things like schools and, you know, things that offer jobs that the government puts the money in.
Yeah. There's a great deal of difference, however, in private enterprise and in government enterprise, because we are paying for government enterprise things. And when you have private enterprise, the company, and when money comes in from outside of a community, into the community, it circulates five times more, I think that information is correct, than money that is made in trade within a community.
Oh.
Very interesting economic situation.
It
churns that many more times.
Mm-hmm.
Money coming in from outside of a community. In other words, if you have we have an industry in Wadena, and people outside of the community buy our commodity, their money comes back to our community, and this money from outside is then used for payroll. This circulates five times more in a community than money that is in a service trade that's traded with the community. That's right, it trades around and around. And you go to the grocery store, you buy groceries, they buy groceries, this type of thing, and it circulates. So out, money coming from people outside of the community circulates five times more than money.
manufacturing turns five times more money in a community than a service industry in a community.
And that's very interesting.
You hire five people to work in a plant making widgets and exporting them from Minnesota to Seattle, that they make five times more turns in the money than they would by hiring five school teachers.
Well, first you've got to have the population.
Yeah, you have to have a population-based building.
Yeah.
It sounds to me like we are, and this is my first night here, so I don't know where you all have been with this, but that we are in a trade-off between a corporate justice and an individual justice.
That's right.
Here. Mm-hmm. So that from an environmental point of view, we can look at this issue of a ski resort or the decline of the timber industry. And that environmentally may serve the corporate good. It maintains a more pure environment. But there are people who are already established here, and there is a certain injustice implied here when they are suddenly out of work and forced to move because of that. And it's at some point, it seems that we have to make some type of a stand and recognize that there will be some partial injustice, at least, that then we have to somehow assume responsibility for providing for the individual to maintain the corporate good. And it reminds me a whole lot of Reinhold Niebuhr's argument in terms of just war, of a corporate ethic and an individual ethic. It ends up being different depending on whether you're siding with the community or are looking at it from an individual perspective.
Yeah, I'm not. Go ahead.
No, did you want to answer?
Yeah, I'm not real sure that that I understand the distinction between the corporate ethic and individual ethic in this case. I think I see what you're getting at. We're talking about individual families in this case, in that community that had been on incomes under the timbering industry and are presently unemployed or underemployed. But it's also a community issue there. It's not just the individual families. So in a sense, we're talking about an isolated part of the country, if that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, you're talking about a fairly isolated community compared with the greater community that uses...
whose interest it would be to keep that area pristine. Yeah. Okay, that's a good point. And that again raises the questions of who decides what's the good of that individual community, and is that good of the community different from the good of the nation or the world?
I guess we have to define what community is.
Yeah, I would pose it. The question is, what is community at that point? Because you can have a nice, clean environment and have no industry there, because we're sending it all down south of the border, where there's hardly any regulations down there. And we can then have the smokestacks and everything else over there, and we're still polluting the air. In fact, we're polluting a lot more because there's no regulations, and if we would put some of that in that pristine valley.
Yeah, production is cheaper.
And all those quote, developing countries, the net result, you know, they're developing because of what I would like to say, and I think you started off with this, with our need to consume more and more and more. And so they are exporting to us and polluting the environment at the same time, so we can live in a
cleaner environment.
Cleaner environment. And it's not easy.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess that's what I was going to maybe want to focus on or just make some points about, because it seems like in some ways, on one hand, we're discussing this kind of on the level of already accepting that there's pollution, and then already accepting that we live a standard of living here in this country that we'll just go ahead and say is all right still, and so now let's just deal with the pollution in a way that we can at least control it or minimize it. And even previous to that, I mean, even more of the symptom to the problem or the actual infection of the problem is that we have become very spoiled with such a sophisticated lifestyle. I mean, it's very obvious that the countries that are polluted are the first world multiple countries who have been striving for development in a lot of ways that some of which are good, some of which are very questionable. And the third world countries, you know, if they don't have first world industries in them, are not polluting their environment anywhere, you know, anywhere near to the degree that we are. So it's like, just, you know, even more, for me, I guess, what I'm more bothered by even than just defining the controls that we should have or how to clean up what we do have now, I think we even need to continue to scale down a little bit in some of our desires as a nation and work more toward community and human services. I mean, that's really what's lacking. That's where we have, you know, poverty and homeless. And I think that we are really moving away from human services because they don't provide economic benefits, quote unquote. And it's like a real, for me, there's a lot of values really need to be questioned here.
I'm glad you raised that issue. Even while I said that, when I talked about minimizing pollution, I'm aware of that. You want to get in there?
Well, if I heard that correctly, you were saying third world countries don't have first.
If they don't have first,
industries are not environmentally as harsh as we are.
Well, they don't pollute. They don't pollute.
I think what she's saying
I've
is.
I've got some real hang-ups with that question. Because
I don't know.
You take Haiti, for instance, which used to have trees, doesn't have a single tree standing today. Not one. And it's the poorest country, at least in the Western world. You take Brazil, the interior of Brazil, which, well, they do have first world. We'll take Ethiopia, another country that's the poorest country in Africa, possibly, doesn't have a single tree standing. They've denuded it. They've ruined it. They've also got the experience, both of them experienced drought, famine, and terrible pollution.
I would pose the question, though, are they the ones that are doing it, or those who consume the things that they produce is doing it?
What have you consumed from Ethiopia in the last week?
I would say that the first world overall has been consuming a lot more of third world produced goods than the third world.
That's true. Third world countries are net exporters.
Right.
And sir, a lot of the desertification of Africa has very much been caused by first world influence. And I know, I mean, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Mali, Northwest Africa, and the village that I lived in grew a lot of cotton, which they then exported to Europe. And they actually used a lot of their land, you know, cut down more trees so that they could use a lot of their land because Europe gave them a good price to grow cotton. And they even sacrificed sometimes growing the millet and the corn that they really needed because they wanted the money. And what did they use the money for? They used the money for taxes that the French had imposed upon them as a nation, which they never had before, and then for luxury goods, for tobacco, for cassette radios, for you know, other kinds of Western, you know, luxury items. So it's like it's still very much hooked into the influence of the first world in the third world.
Well, I agree. The world is interdependent, but I don't think that's necessarily entirely the fault of this country. Right? They want to consume things in their own. They want to consume things as well, and to consume, supposedly, except we might be one of the first countries to prove them wrong, you have to pay your way, and if they want to do that, what are they going to do it? They have to do it for the base resources you have. That's how we do it. We pay for it by exporting food, by growing food. That's how we pay for it. By producing things and selling them. That's how we pay our way to consumers.
I think one of the points that Sharon was making, and I think it's still valid, though I agree that what you've said about economics and development in the third world, I believe is also true. But I think that implicit in what Sharon was saying was a point about the lower scale of economic development and resource use. That raises, that your whole point raises a really significant issue, and that is how much are we willing to scale down. And it is true that at the level of community where the community is growing its own food, and we see the example somewhat here where we can somewhat have control over the waste we recycle, in a small enough community that's possible. And in many communities that has been true in so-called third world countries, where there, it's a smaller scale of agriculture, of resource use. And but then that raises the question, you know, here at Holden, people have been willing to, I mean, have come here because they want a simpler lifestyle. That's my impression anyway. People have chosen to come here because of that value. And that's a value that I've had. And but I have found it more and more difficult as I've gone along in conversations with people to convince people, and it's just a difficult issue. It's difficult to convince people it's for their own good that they should live a simpler lifestyle. And then again, the issue that Sharon raised about service versus the manufacturing or industrial economy is an interesting one. And it gets back to the question about what do we need to support a reasonable standard of living, even, yes.
Well, I was just going to say that I agree that we accept temporarily, very temporarily, a scaled down, simple lifestyle. Well, I was almost first in the line last night to get ice cream after having had a simple supper. I suggested to them that we should not open the snack shop last night and give all that money to World Hunger. But that wasn't very well received. Not in the line where I was.
That's right.
So we're very fickle, really. You know, we're really very fickle that we accepted having a 60-cent reduction in cost for that simple meal last night. But I spent 75 cents for the ice cream afterwards.
Not everyone did that, though. That's not
no, but I, there was a did. Tremendous line. The line went all the way around the corner
You're
of the building.
Right.
So I'm just saying that's a simple, you know, I'm saying I'm very fickle about this. And I may say that I accept that simple lifestyle and I had that simple supper. But I was among those, the longest line yet. You know, at the snack shop.
I know the snack shop.
It was long enough. Usual seemed about usual.
Maybe more easy.
When I was in the Peace Corps and we went to South America, everything, now, virtually everything we did, project wise, was to increase the health and well being of communities, rural communities, and the general populace. And those projects were all what I would call environmental, were more complicated processes. We brought schools, communities never had them, which means cement buildings were building. We built bridges and roads and things that would bring in more activity, more economic activity, not less. And you try to bring in like good health care and services. Those things cost money, and they also add to the complication of life. I mean, those people all of a sudden, instead of having five kids and three die in the first year, they have six kids. And all of them lived to age 10 or something. It makes life a lot more complicated. So we didn't make it any simpler for them. But everything we did was try to make economics, was to try to make it closer to our lifestyle, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And that was to consume. We added to their consumption level and their expectations.
Could you, I wasn't sure if, were you saying that that was a virtue or a problem?
Well, that's a good question, because now all of a sudden, her comment would make me question whether what we were doing and what we are doing, because I think the Peace Corps hasn't changed radically since I was there, is may not be a virtue. It may be a mistake. It's like the old argument, should we send free wheat to starving Africa, and therefore depress the price of wheat to wheat growers in Africa, and they quit growing it. Uh-huh. They grow drugs instead, because they make more money. The only argument that I've ever had successfully with any person that takes drugs, especially ones that are not, I don't know what the word is, or would not be considered drug addicts, I guess, is that every time you take drugs, you are raping some foreign country because they are no longer, they're not producing food for themselves, they're producing a substance which has no value to make money. And that's the and what they're creating is a murder system. In my case, they're raping the land under because they're taking out all the trees and planting whatever they plant.
Yes.
And what you said about drugs, you can say that about coffee and sugar.
Yes.
And cotton.
Bananas.
Too.
Bananas.
Those are really important issues, and that
tobacco.
Yeah, and that's where it gets to what we are consuming. And how we support the exploitation of those countries, but what do we, you know, how do we address those kinds of questions? That are we willing to give up coffee so that people can grow food on their own land?
About a year ago on public radio, I heard I wish I knew, had more information, maybe someone here does. They said that a bill had passed that linked Form A with environmental policy from federal government. And it was real poignant at the time, but it was a year ago that I heard it, but I don't know if anybody else has other information around it.
I haven't heard that either.
I wonder how much of our foreign governmental policy and our economic policy by multinational corporations would change if we made more of a conscious effort to focus on the environmental problems here at home. Kind of, if you put it on a family scale, if you're really working hard within your family to live in a simpler fashion, clean up your acts, that there is there's a filter out theory that I would hope could work, and maybe that is one of the ways to clean up our act around the world, by cleaning up our act here so that we are internally aware.
So we're more conscious of the level of use of resources that we are. I think Darius earlier in the week gave the example of the garbage that we were talking about recycling, the garbage that his family produced, and his neighbors had said, "Well, how come you only have one garbage can out in front of your place each week, and while the others had four or five?" And so that, I think that is important, and perhaps it's not just a matter of developing recycling programs in our congregations, but talking about simpler lifestyle and generating less garbage in the first place.
You know, it's a major achievement in our church to get rid of styrofoam cups.
Did you do it?
Yep.
And who does the dishes?
It's called an edict by the pastor.
Who does the dishes?
Who does the dishes?
Well, we haven't made it to dishes. We moved to paper, which was a step in the right direction. We couldn't have done that one by democracy. It wouldn't have worked.
But in many places, I think you wouldn't even, I mean, if you suggested that, the people would say, why?
You mean why?
No awareness whatsoever of what that is. I think that would probably fit a large part of the country and a large number of people, probably the majority of people.
You really think
why.
So? Yeah. It strikes me that 10 years ago, we would not have had to ask why. But 10 years ago, people would have known why.
You mean because of the crises in the environment? That
yeah, general level of awareness was such that people would have automatically known that that was an issue. But you're saying that today we would not... Wow.
I think it depends what part of the environmental impact you're talking about. I don't think people are that conscious of, say, styrofoam and other plastics.
Of resource use, of
Because yeah. If they were, we'd be embarrassed.
A couple of people, why don't you?
I've received Holden resource packets long before we ever managed to actually get here this time for the first time. And a lot of just those ideas, you know, I picked up in reading those. And, you know, some of them we have put into practice. And we talked about fickleness, that's true. But all of us do certain things more easily than others. So we're probably doing the recycling things that are easy for us, but I think that we would still be open to more simplifying things in our life, but we need that education. And I really wasn't aware of the styrofoam thing until maybe a year or so ago. We had a speaker into the church, and she was keyed into that kind of thing. She brought her own coffee mug with her and told us cheerfully that this was her contribution to not using styrofoam cups in our meeting. You know, she had her own cup with her.
I think
I've been around in the last 10 years, and I hadn't thought about that particular thing, but I haven't been an active and environmental thing.
That is such a beautiful witness. You know, if nothing else, if we could all, no matter where we go, bring our little cup with us.
And it was cheerful.
Just such
and
a silent was, witness, you know, and just hold out. You don't have to say, this is why I'm doing it. People will ask.
Yeah.
She did say, but it was not at all it wasn't in a preachy way at all. It was just a cheerfully, in case you're wondering why I've got this, you know.
Well,
so I think that the educational things that we do are helpful, and even though we are fickle, that if people do feel responsibility, they will find the things that they are able to do in their lives. I know we are looking for what is the next thing that we could do.
A question on the styrofoam cups, does it, besides being biodegradable, does it do something with the ozone layer too? I mean, is that, I've heard things about every time you break it.
The production of it and the burning of it, what is the, it's a toxic substance that it releases into the atmosphere when it's burned. But production, what is it in the use of petroleum in production?
The hydro is cheaper than people.
I don't know.
The hydro carbon.
I think there's kind of, the hydrocarbons, yeah, that are released.
I have a thought about that, talking about the strange things, because this is in Portland, Oregon. I think we might be one of the first cities in the country to eliminate styrofoam.
Yeah.
Well, it's, they're working on it very actively now, and it's in the voting procedure.
Berkeley's done the same thing.
Berkeley's going to probably beat us out. But anyway. we deliver Meals on Wheels to Shelly-Ems and so on and so forth. Every one of those meals, now it's an amazing program because they make these thousands of meals and they go out and deliver them. They're all delivered and they're all hot. But every one of them's in a styrofoam container.
They're hot when they're
delivered. Every one of them. And it gets down to the issue, well, I got this lady who's 80 years old, or all of them, several of them are old and some are young, makes no difference. And we're delivering this hot meal. Now the styrofoam industry tells me, if we don't deliver them in styrofoam packages, they won't be hot. The meals won't be hot.
Oh, we've got nice ones in clothes.
Do you? Mm-hmm. You're using paper, what do you deliver?
No, it's a plastic material that we wash and use again.
Our meals, you bring it back and recycle them?
Thousands of them every day.
Add it to your cost, to your delivery meals?
But the cynicism of what happens when somebody gets sick?
You just have to pick them up.
But by washing them yourself? Who accepts the liability?
They're washed in a garment, I mean, they're washing, like we wash here at home.
You pick them up? I mean, you deliver them out in
the
morning and then pick them up?
Back.
Or you pick them up the next day?
No, as you deliver, they come in about six meals all stacked together. And as you deliver the meal, then you pick up the container from the day before and just replace it where the hot meal was. And then you, in our cases, they're all done in a central hospital. And they even, you know, wash them and everything. Nothing.
Are they still in styrofoam containers?
No, it's a plastic, a heavy plastic.
Who told you that the styrofoam was the only thing that you could send them in hot?
Well, that's the argument you read in the press.
And the styrofoam company said, the question is, whose interests are being served by that point of view?
Well, it's not true. They're all reusing it.
Yeah.
But what are the alternatives?
Good point.
I know darn well that paper will make, if there are certain paper, they will be cold when they get there.
Sure.
These are important questions, but the woman here back here has been trying to get in for a while.
Yeah, in Berkeley we ban styrofoam, but the thing that, I mean, I just noticed styrofoam everywhere. You know, I haven't noticed any place that used to use it that doesn't anymore. And then it just makes me think like someone referred to 10 years ago, we would have. You know, there would be more awareness. It just seems like 10 years ago in Berkeley, instead of just saying styrofoam's illegal, there would have been, you know, lots of energy put out by lots of people to get people motivated not to use styrofoam, instead of just saying it's illegal to sell styrofoam.
It's un-American not to use styrofoam.
Yeah, that's right.
Also, since the fact that Tylenol scare, I mean, the things are packaged in there, yeah. And everything has to, I mean, anything it buys.
That's double plastic wrap.
I saw a film on Channel 9 about when the plastic gets into the sea, I mean, it kills animals and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They're getting caught up in it.
Yeah.
Does anybody here live in a city where there's curbside recycling?
Yeah.
Portland.
Seattle
did that last year. And it was overwhelmingly successful. Mm-hmm. And I think that
it's only
something about where people's consciences are too. Yeah.
But Seattle, I don't think Seattle's a typical city on that level. I mean, I think that people in Seattle, a lot of people in Seattle are environmentally conscious, and that's part of even the reason why they go there. I really don't think that the cities are comparable on that level, because back east, people just don't have that mentality of environmental issues to the degree that people in the Northwest do.
Oh, didn't somebody say a suburb of Minneapolis had curbside recycling?
Minneapolis does. St. Cloud, Minnesota.
So it's, I think there is a growing awareness.
It's growing, but I think that Seattle's exceptional. Seattle, yeah. Portland.
Yeah.
If it's made convenient.
Yeah, right.
It has to be made convenient.
I think Steve had a comment.
Yes, I was going to say that a lot of the time it's really easy to kind of discourage some stuff, but it's really easy to make easy solutions to environmental problems. I think it's really important to realize this. It takes a lot of sacrifices. And like styrofoam cups may not be a large sacrifice washing that stuff, but I saw an article on Newsweek last week that talks about somebody was giving Michael Dukakis a hard time about using his 1950-something snowblower on his driveway. And he said Michael Dukakis is four jobs, but he still uses his old snowblower instead of throwing it out and buying a new one. And so it sounds ridiculous in a way, but in a way there's a grain of truth there too. Someone makes those styrofoam cups, and so you have to be willing to sacrifice not only the convenience of that styrofoam cup, you have to be willing to say that we're serious enough about this to figure out other jobs for these people and stuff like that. And that includes recycling the same way. Like even by like a recycling copper pipe, you're taking some copper miner's job away in a sense. Mm-hmm. You're also saving the environment a lot of grief. But it's important to be very holistic, to be very serious about that kind of thing.
Yeah, good point.
We heard about that a number of years ago when Ohio was trying to get a 5-cent surcharge on every can of pop, the way Michigan has.
And 10 cents.
Mm-hmm. Power telling us about all the jobs are going to be lost and so forth because of that. And it was overwhelmingly defeated. In fact, we tried it twice and it's lost both hands.
We've got about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to throw out just a few more ideas about what can be done, and like invite you to do the same. We've already talked about education. I think that's important. That's something we can do in our churches, or encourage environmental education in our schools. I've participated in that with a school camping program out in Michigan. Some schools have that. Community recycling. And there are ways to influence legislation in our communities, our states. There are environmental groups around that you can take part in. Many of you are probably aware and taking part in some of those. I'll list just a few. Heard the names, and you can throw out others. There's the Natural Resources Defense Council, which introduces legislation or advocates for legislation. Wilderness Society, Audubon Society, public interest research groups in the various states. Any others that you have heard of that are
Sierra
Club? Right, that's one I've forgotten. They're a really, really strong one.
Yeah.
Strong lobby. Yeah, right.
Amicus.
Yeah, someone mentioned that to me. Amicus, which is now. Tell me again.
I just looked at a journal last week at a friend's house that was environmental issues.
Yeah, it's. Some kind, it has the word defense in its title. It advocates legislation, I believe, and lawsuits. Yeah. So there are these things we can do as individuals and our communities, in our churches. There have been things done, and I wanted to point this out to you. There was a conference last summer. It's called the North American Conference on Christianity and Ecology. So it was an ecumenical gathering beginning to try to address some of the issues of environmental concerns. And the World Council of Churches has done that starting in 1970 already. Mm-hmm. So things are being done. And you might, if you're thinking about doing something in your local churches, call some of the groups to get speakers or whatever, some of those environmental groups. Other thoughts?
I was just going to say, we have the proceedings from that North American Conference on Christianity and Ecology thing in our bookstore. It's really a good collection of presentations and ideas and reflections from a lot of people.
Yeah, I saw it there. The bookstore has lots of good books on environmental issues and on ecological concern.
I think we started out with a topic about who pays. And I guess my reflection on this is that, very simplistic, that the reason that we have a lot of economic development and why costs are low is because we haven't paid for our garbage.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And it seems to me that whether we pay for it on an individual basis or we pay for it on a community basis through taxes, there's going to be a price paid for that dimension of our community living. Mm-hmm. And we have to be prepared for that.
Exactly.
I think we can talk all about use the word pristine all we want, but finally there has to be a compromise. Somebody's going to pay for it, and in fact, the consumer's always going to pay for it. But whether it comes through direct consumption or whether it comes through a community, it's going to be paid for. And that's terribly cynical, but that's just a fact that it's a matter that we must pay for our garbage. And we haven't done that. And a lot of people are not prepared to do that.
And it's not cynical, that's the reality.
There's no free lunch. It's not an American problem. It's not an American problem, it's a world problem. And I haven't checked to see my labels, because I'm sure that I've gotten the benefits of other people's production around the world, who haven't paid for their garbage in terms of pollution. And that's why you can buy products cheaply, and I buy them too. I have to admit that, I buy them too. I bet if we go around this room, there isn't, every label here is not made in America. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we don't see that as an international
Seattle is starting to pay for it because you're going to raise garbage rates next year.
Oh, it's awful.
Because of the trash disposition problem.
I'm not just talking about garbage. I'm talking about all production.
Yeah.
It isn't just garbage. I'm talking about refrigerators, stoves, cars, whatever you want to talk about. Every production dimension has a disposal of the effluent that we haven't paid for.
That's right.
And that's part of the problem.
And that really needs to be part of the educational process. Mm-hmm. As in the early days of the environmental movement, it was always said, there's no free lunch. You know, that's just part of the ecology of it. But it's, people don't hear that very easily. You know, it means coming out of their pockets. Their lifestyle is threatened. So. Yes.
And even if, as a country, we got our act together as such, and that we could demonstrate to the world that we were environmentally sound and that we were doing all these things, and then we would try to suggest to these third world companies that they do the same, they simply say, you've made it to where you are by all of the cheapened material that you've gotten rid of, and now you're clean. Give us a chance to get
That's
up there,
right.
too.
Yeah.
So it will be extremely difficult to try to get some kind of worldwide commission that will agree to something as far as some major environmental issues are concerned. I'm very pessimistic about that.
And all the reason we have to work at it all harder.
That's right. Yep. That's right. And continue to talk and educate people as much as we can. Thank you all for your participation. Good discussion.